the cities. In this regard, so I will leave the floor to our next speaker, Mr. Geoffrey Payne. Has an experience of 50 years and India, Egypt, Papua New Guinea, and some many other countries are of his countries of study, and UNDP and Habitat, UN Habitat-like institutions are the institutions he delivers consultancy services to, and for 30 years has been training, and his daughter Tanya is following the tracks of his father and traveling the world, taking photographs, and also is in journalism. So without further ado, I would like to now leave the floor to Mr. Geoffrey Payne.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to contribute to this session and to meet some very great friends that I've known for more years than I care to acknowledge. I would like to compliment Hans' presentation, who gave a very comprehensive summary of the issues that were presented and discussed, by giving perhaps, if you'll excuse me, a personal perspective on these issues. So if I could have the first slide. Oh, thank you. The situation in 1976 was in some respects very different, in other respects very similar to today. I was not at Vancouver, but I had just finished a research report on urban housing and planning in Ankara. Having come here first of all in 1974, I finished the report about 1977, but as Habitat One was taking place, I was actually working with John Turner in London, teaching on the courses of urban planning and housing. And of course, it was a great privilege to see one of the great figures of housing globally, some of the giants of on whose shoulders most of my generation has been building, to see the principles that he was espousing. I was once asked what I thought was the greatest idea that I've ever seen, or the last great idea. And I think it comes down to what John Turner and his colleagues, William Mangan and others that Hannah's referred to, was saying, was that this was the way of looking at the world in a different way. My generation was trained that architects and planners had the information, the knowledge, and the experience to plan and manage cities and to provide people with adequate housing. We then realized, of course, that a large proportion of the world cannot conform to the standards and norms that professionals and governments expect of them. The result is large proportions of unplanned, unauthorized, in fact it was planned, but according to very different criteria to the ones the planners and professionals were looking at. And what John did, which was a great service to the professions and to the understanding of these issues, was to show that the informal, the self-generated housing was in fact part of the solution, not the problem. In other words, he looked at the world through the other end of the telescope, and I think that was very important in Habitat One. The other thing which I was very impressed by was that his view of looking at housing was that housing is a process, and it's what it does for people, not just what it is. And it's therefore vital that people have a say in the design, location, and use of their housing. And Habitat One, he made the greatest contribution with his book, Housing by People, which I think was a good way of putting it. And I was impressed to see, looking through my notes of the Habitat One process, of course we all pick on the things that we find of particular interest. But for me, the interest on inequitable growth will lead to unacceptable living conditions unless radical action is taken. Now that was 40 years ago. Inequitable growth, and we're looking at a world today which is highly unequal and becoming more unequal. It also established the right of housing as a human right, which we're still trying to recognize and to implement. And Section D of the report noted that private ownership contributes to social injustice. Now, of course, individual ownership has been promoted globally by national governments, by international agencies, as the solution to the problem. And yet, 40 years ago, it was already recognized, if it got too far, to lead to injustice. So those are my reflections on Habitat One. And I think that was a major event because it focused international attention on both the scale of the challenge and the nature of the challenge. And it enabled all the building professions and planning professions, architects, engineers, surveyors, quantity surveyors, and so on, to see the issue in a more holistic way. At the time of Habitat One, as I said, I was working on a project in Egypt. And in most consultancy projects at that time, it was normal for consultants to have their own office. And then you would have a meeting room at the end of the corridor to discuss the overall issues. When we did our project, there was not enough space to operate in that way. We all had our desks around the side of the room. And in the middle was a table, a big table, where we would sit for meetings. But on that table was a map of the city we were trying to plan. That meant psychologically, we were continually aware that we were contributing to something bigger than ourselves, something that was more important than our own individual expertise. And I think that holistic approach is something which I've always regarded as one of the elements of the success of that project and something that I've always recommended and tried to achieve ever since. So a holistic, multidisciplinary approach, rather than the silos in which the professions often work, I think was central. Moving on to Habitat 2, before Habitat 2, my research on all of these issues led me to publish a book, to jointly edit a book, which was called The Living City Towards a Sustainable Future. John Turner, Arif Hassan, and Herbert Girardet all contributed very important chapters to that book. I was rather flattered 2 months ago to receive a notice from the publishers saying they plan to reissue it. Now, obviously, it's nice to have a book reissued 29 years after you've published it. But the subtitle of the book was Towards a Sustainable Future. And that rather depressed me, because if you think that the book is still needed 29 years later, then obviously the lessons were not learned in the first place. So I think it's a rather sobering as well as a flattering experience that this book is still considered necessary or appropriate. For me, the most important element of Habitat 2, which I was able to attend in Istanbul and which was another major global experience, was that while there was not much on finance or land management, not as much as I was hoping, having made that my area of specialization, what was very important, I still remember many sessions in which Herbert Girardet, who had contributed to this book on the living city, was being always surrounded by journalists, because he was talking about the ecology footprint of urban areas, how urban areas expanding into agricultural areas, the tensions that that creates culturally and economically and environmentally, and how we need to put land to efficient use socially, culturally, and economically, try and create compact cities and in order to sustain, protect the environment. Moving on to Habitat, there were many people present, as I said, the book that I contributed to has now been reissued. So moving on to Habitat 3 in Quito. I was invited by UN Habitat, and I suppose this is where my work in the previous 20 years had enabled me to become better known in terms of looking at land issues. I'd published widely on land tenure issues. I was very angry with the way that the World Bank had been promoting individual ownership. And I questioned a lot of the assumptions and the claims that the bank was making, and which others had been making, promoting individual ownership as the solution to global problems, and saying that if the developing world followed the West, then individual ownership was the means of accessing credit, that credit would enable you to open a business and everyone could escape poverty and become middle-class income groups. The research I did on that demonstrated that this is a false claim. There is no empirical evidence that I have seen since to support that, although I remain open to any evidence to the contrary. Of course, I'm not saying that individual ownership is wrong. I own my own house. It would be hypocritical of me to say that people should not own that. But experience has taught me that that should not be for the for everybody. It is only is certainly not suitable for the young, the old, or the poor. So Habitat 3, really, I was invited to contribute to moderate a special session on housing, in which I was asked to give some of these comments and to introduce some of the key speakers on that. I'll talk about that in just a minute. I was also invited by Han Verschuer's organization at the Catholic University of Leuven to contribute to a session, give a keynote paper on a parallel session on community development, land tenure, and social innovation. And that enabled me to present some of the work that we've been doing on land tenure and property rights. I'm very pleased to say that that will be a contribution to a book which Catholic University, Leuven, and also the Network Association of European Researchers on Urbanization in the South will be published later this year. And then third, I was a member of a panel. It was very interesting talking to a wide range of contributors, mayors, consultants, NGOs, and academics from different countries. We were all asked to speak for a few minutes. And that, for me, was another major opportunity. Because one of the concerns I have about all these sort of conferences and the World Urban Fora is that it can be a tendency for us to preach to the converted. I'm sure all of us here today are concerned about the issues of urbanization, of urban opportunities, inequality, and the environmental challenge. But I do think that one of the big opportunities, certainly in Habitat 3, was participating with people from very different backgrounds and different perspectives. Because the key issue for me is that we do not just talk among ourselves, but we reach out to the wider public and engage with the political debates of in our own countries. So those are the three things. And in addition, my wife, who's left to go home this morning, but she was invited by UN Habitat to moderate another special session on housing at the center of sustainable development. And I attended an event organized by Catherine Golder-Pongratz, who had made a film going back to the archive material that John Turner had done the previous 20 years for Habitat One. And she's made a film on Turner's work by going back to Peru, talking to some of the original households who have been involved in the settlements, and also talking to their children and the next generation. So it was a longitudinal assessment of what's happened and what lessons can be learned. So that was a very good opportunity to go back and complete the circle. Now, of course, Habitat 3 had various objectives: identify key structural and global issues, the challenges to housing, exchange perspective on placing housing at the center of the agenda, proposing ways forward to guarantee the right to adequate housing in the implementation of the new urban agenda. That was structured in four parts, outlining the challenges, panel discussions, and so on. I think on reflection, one of the disappointments of Habitat 3 is that it did not come up with operational conditions and requirements whereby governments agreed to implement the recommendations which have been made in the new urban agenda. There is a concern I have that it's saying all the right things, but not in a way which is binding upon anybody. Now, of course, one has to accept that if all the countries in the world are negotiating, you are inevitably going to achieve a compromise. That is, I think, an understandable limitation of any international UN Habitat conference. At the same time, I think there is a danger that if we accept this as the basis for action, we can guarantee that only those countries that are really committed to achieving the SDGs and the MDGs and all the other objectives of the New Urban Agenda, they will be the only ones that make a difference. Everyone else will carry on as normal. I've just come back from Bhutan. 2 days ago, I was in Bhutan. For me, what was the amazing experience was that Bhutan in the 1970s changed its definition of development. I was watching the news this morning, and they were talking about a crisis in China and America with trade disputes, how that will affect global economic growth. Everyone talks about GDP as the definition of progress. For me, I've just read a book called GDP, Gross Domestic Problem. And that is a very interesting book I recommend. Bhutan and Vanuatu is one of the most vulnerable environmental countries in the world, one of the poorest. But Vanuatu and Bhutan have defined their definition of development and progress as gross national happiness. New Zealand has changed recently to measuring progress by gross national well-being. For me, this is an exciting opportunity to question for the first time in human history what we mean by progress. Do we need more and more money, more and more stuff, or should we redefine what we mean by a good quality of life? And that for me is what the UN agendas and all the discussions that we have collectively should be about. One of the most passionate contributions at the session I moderated was by Leilana Fari, who was the Special Rapporteur on Housing. And she talked about the need for a passionate recognition of the right to housing. Now, of course, it's all very well to have a right, but if you can't achieve or implement that, it means nothing. It was interesting also the minister from France, of course, giving her government's perspective. And I think as a consultant, as an independent consultant, I'm very conscious that I'm very privileged to see the issues, but I do not have the responsibility of making the compromises necessary to achieve implementation on the ground. So it's very easy for people like me to make grand statements and observations. I fully accept that for people under pressure with ministers demanding attention, how they move forward. But I do think that all of these issues need to be considered in their broadest context. One of the things which I notice has not been addressed at Habitat 3, which has become the issue in the 3 years since, is the climate crisis. So it shows in a way that the things that were addressed in Habitat 1, 2, and 3 about inequality, the need for social justice, the need for human rights in housing, still remains on the top of the agenda, to which we now have to add the environmental crisis of climate heating. And I was very, I think we're all aware that we've now got 16-year-old girls telling world leaders what needs to happen. My generation, our generation around the table here, I think is possibly the luckiest generation in the whole of human history. We are in danger of passing the world on to the younger generation, many of you here in this room, in a very bad state, in a way which you will have to address the indulgent way of life that we have lived and are living. Please accept my apologies from my generation for the world we're passing on to you. We, the four of us, I know, are doing what we can in the years and time that we have left, to remedy and address the challenges. And I hope very much that we'll be able to pass the world on to you in a better state than it is at the moment. But thank you very much for this opportunity.
We would like to thank Mr. Payne for such a comprehensive presentation, a very touching presentation it was actually. So